I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Whether you miss traveling or not, one is likely to have not done as much of it as they'd have liked in this year of COVID. One can get nostalgic for it, even if it's the kind of traveling that Trevor Carolan does. You can read in his latest book, Road Trips, Journeys in the Unspoiled World, fascinating, fun, evocative, sometimes nostalgic moments he's had over the years. There are 19 essays in the book, and they are replete with memorable people and insights into different cultures. There are amazing landscapes, whether just around here in British Columbia or in far-flung places like Laos, Cambodia, Portugal, India, Indonesia, Morocco, or Nepal. I'll ask Mr. Carolan, who joins me now, about what he brings with him as he travels, the way he travels, and some of the unforgettable things he's eaten, seen, and experienced in a lifetime of trekking through the world. The book is from our friends at Mother Tongue Publishing, and as I tell Trevor, there are some places that I'd like to see for myself after reading the book, as well as pieces he's captured so much of in his writing that I have no need to go now. Trevor Carolan started reporting for the Columbian newspaper while in high school in the late 1960s. Since then, he's visited over 50 countries, and he's written numerous books of nonfiction, poetry, and anthologies. He's held a number of senior arts appointments and was even a municipal councillor in North Vancouver. He is a professor emeritus at the University of the Fraser Valley, and he received his PhD in international relations from Bond University, Queensland. He was first on the program in 2015 when he wrote The Literary Storefront, The Glory Years, Vancouver's Literary Center, 1978 to 1985. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Trevor Carolan. Mr. Carolan, good morning.
Good morning.
I guess it's Dr. Carolan, isn't it?
Oh, well, it is, yeah, but that's okay.
I would like to begin, though, before we talk about your book, Road Trips. I've seen the recent post on social media by Richard Mackey about the Ormsby Review.
Right.
And I notice that you're a board of director. What's happening with the publication?
Well, the Ormsby Review has been going now since it got founded by Alan Twigg and Richard Mackey, and it does a great job of covering writing from BC. I just don't know that there's anything like it, really.
It does
a very comprehensive job. But like everything, a couple of grants that were applied for in the past year didn't come through. Mm. And so financially it became a real tight squeeze. And at a recent board meeting, it was decided to try an appeal to readers and friends of the journal. And so that's what took place. And the response has been tremendous.
I must say, seeing the posts that I have and then the responses and then the retweets or the reposts on social media, I'm heartened that so many people have been reading it over the years and feel that it is important and something worthwhile to support, and I urge people listening to do the same.
Well, it blows, you know. I mean, I think maybe in the last 2 days I took a look at the comments that people have been sending in, and it really blows you away. You realize, whoa, people are actually reading our stuff, you know, they're reading what we're trying to do, or what Richard Mackey, the publisher and the editor, is trying to do. He's driving the bus. Some of us offer bits of advice from time to time. That's what directors do on a board. But it's going very well, and he has a terrific cast of contributors.
Indeed.
who are all pitching in to make this go, because we're living in difficult times, especially in the book and publishing industries, you know, the trades, and if we want to keep it going, people have to sort of take a turn at the oars.
absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Trevor, what have these last few months been like for you? I mean, have you been staying close to home?
Well, we've been following Dr. Bonnie Henry's advice pretty closely. I mean, I don't walk out the door unless I've got a mask on, and that's since back in March.
Uh-huh.
I take it pretty seriously. I used to work in the operating room when I was younger, and so wearing a mask isn't something that's unfamiliar to me. But the idea of getting ill from viruses is familiar to me, and getting ill out on the road at different times is pretty familiar, and I'd prefer not to have to go through that again.
Right.
So we're staying close to home and picking our spots, and our outings are basically shopping expeditions to a couple of ethnic places that we go to buy our vegetables and our bread and And if we get extravagant, we go to the farmer's market. That's been the one thing that we do, where it's outdoors and they control the capacity. And can I put a plug in for the winter market that takes place on the weekend on Sundays at the P&E grounds?
Oh, really? There's one there?
I
did see that. Yeah.
Terrific.
I was at the Cannoli King there on Renfrew.
Oh, yeah.
And I saw the sign one time, and always wanted to go, so it is worthwhile to go there, isn't it?
It's more than worthwhile. It's really heartening, and it's all food. It's not jewelry or T-shirts or things that people have knitted. It's a food market, and they're doing a real good job. I mean, you can pretty well just about get most of your groceries there. You have to still buy some milk at somewhere, but you can get pretty well everything else there.
So one of the things that when your publisher Mona Furtig sent me the book, I tried reading it, and I found it hard to read because I missed. I'm not a great traveler like you are, but I did miss some aspects of traveling.
Right.
So then I read it again in the summer and enjoyed it a great deal, and picked it up again over the last week or so in preparing for our chat, and again found it. Just delightful in so many aspects that we'll talk about in just a sec. But are there certain aspects of traveling that you don't miss, say?
Not as well, going to airports or having to go through certain airports.
Yeah.
There are certain airports we try and give a miss to, just they're difficult. But travel itself is just, I've always found it very exhilarating. The moment you're either getting out on the road hitchhiking or getting on the bus and looking out the window and making yourself comfortable, or getting on the train or on the plane and, strapping your seatbelt in. Mm. There's just something where it's almost like there's a mind wash takes over. It's like standing beside a mountain stream. The sound of that mountain stream washes everything away, and you get this moment of extreme kind of peacefulness, of optimism and hope. And it's a wonderful moment, that moment of embarking on a journey. And I think, history has given, there's a few great travel books in history which have stood the test of time. I think Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is one, and I think Basho's The Narrow Road to the Deep North is another one from Japan, and there are these moments where suddenly you can feel the joy. I think Kerouac talks about a golden festival of rejoicement, something like that. There's a moment where we're about to embark on this expedition, this journey, and things are going to take place, things are going to change, things are going to happen, that it feels wonderful.
The sense that I get as I read the book and read of your travels over the years is that you're having a lot of fun, and you're enjoying the people that you meet, and there's a certain feeling. I'm trying to how to put this. You and me, we could walk out the door of our wherever we are. You're in North Van, I'm here in East Van, and we can encounter people from all over the world.
Yeah.
But there is something unique about seeing different people in their own homes, if you will.
Well, I think that's part of the joy of travel. First of all, I think there's that sense of gratitude that we're able to be in these places. That underscores in everything that I'm doing always. It's a kind of almost a spiritual virtue or something, a spiritual commandment. The first of the commandments is gratitude, I think. And if you're a writer, what you do is you end up taking a sense of what's happening, the people that you're meeting, the architecture you're seeing, the sights that you're seeing, the smells, all the sensory impressions. And what happens is, we begin taking our own sensory impressions, and we use our own imagination to start weaving that into a kind of story. And the best stories usually involve some type of human experience. And I think that goes back to what you were just saying, Joseph, about meeting people. I think my wife says I can probably talk to a tree or a rock or something. And, there's always something interesting. If you make an effort, I think you mentioned there's people from all over in Vancouver.
Sure.
I was an old stamp collector when I was a boy. Everybody used to collect stamps when I was younger, before we had video games and all the rest of it. And if you collected stamps, you learned a little bit about all these different countries around the world, some of their heroes, some of their flowers, some of their animals, the things that they exported, some of their great figures or historical moments. And I think it gives you a lifelong cache of information so that when you meet somebody, oh, you're from Nigeria. Well, what else? Yeah, I remember Dick Tiger, the great boxer. Oh, yeah, and they'll start talking about Dick Tiger, the boxer. Or they'll start talking about, I always used to wonder, what were those boxes that we'd see stacked up on the beach on those stamps from down in Fiji? Copra. What's copra, you know? And they go, oh, well, that's that gnarly dried coconut meat that we do that they use to melt down for oil. And oh, and they'll go, it smells terrible. You've got a conversation going. That one little piece of information, it can just help unlock a conversation, and it can become a really productive, entertaining moment, actually. I think life is full of those if you're interested in the world or the people in it.
Yeah, the sense that I got as I was rereading parts of the book the last day or two is that we're all unique, but you know, I guess that's the humanity of it all, that we're all the same, aren't we?
Well, ultimately, I mean, we're human beings, and there's a certain, you know, there's a, every day that we wake up, the possibilities are new. That's great. And I think if you're a writer, this whole business of living, it has to do something with the idea of awakening, of awakening ourselves, and that's what travel does as well. If you're a traveler, a real committed traveler, then it's a sense of waking up. It's coming upon these short stories where we're looking at panoramas of shifting moments and incidents within the larger frame of our human reference. That's how travel works. And you know, there is a sense of travel being something that's fluid and moving, and there is also this idea of tourism, which is sometimes less active, or it's a bit more contained, or it's a little more compartmentalized for people, you know, with busy lives, and they have a week or 2 weeks or 10 days here or there.
I guess so, we also conflate the two, don't we?
I think we do. There's an old sense, though. I think that Europeans especially, they have a sense of travel, of being en voyage, of being like Arthur Rimbaud, you know, is going out there on a journey. You're going on a journey. And sometimes these are open-ended journeys. We're not quite sure when we're going to get back, or if we're going to get back. So I think there is that sense of being en voyage, traveling, and then there's a sense of, you know, going on a shorter term vacation.
Yeah, yeah.
And we need those, but it's probably good to remember the tourism, where it got invented. I think people say it got invented in ancient Rome, where Rome was doing very well as an empire, and it had a successful middle and upper class, and some of them were acquiring a little time and ability to travel, and some people came up with this idea of, why not go to Egypt and see the ancient monuments of the world? So even in Rome 2,000 years ago, they were going off to look at things that came 1,000 years before them.
Mm.
And so the package tour industry was born. It's not a recent phenomenon, but it's been around a while. So I think we owe it to the pyramids and the Sphinx in Egypt, to the idea of a tourism industry. And, you know, that's something that we all have to reckon with.
Understanding people the way that you do, this marvelous ability that you have to get along with people as well as you do, makes me wonder, as I'm reading the book, do you understand why people sometimes do bad things?
Whoa, that's a tough question. Why do people sometimes do bad things? There's a couple of incidents like that in the book where bad things have happened. Some sense of perhaps desperation in their life. That's as much as I could give them. Why do good people do bad things? Sometimes it happens, and I'm not going to try and explain that for you. You know, the Dalai Lama says sometimes if we come out of these experiences having had bad things done to us, he says we have to try and separate the bad thing from the person.
Mm.
That's the only way there might ever be any kind of reconciliation.
Trying to
come to terms with some of these terrible things. Maybe to depersonalize it a little, my wife and I were traveling just before the pandemic broke out in Cambodia and Laos. The travels in Laos are in the book. They conclude the book, actually. It's the most recent story. It's less than a year old. But traveling in Cambodia, where you've been through a land of just enormous, unspeakable bestiality that was done, or if you're traveling in southern Poland and you're in that area and down in Silesia near where Auschwitz was, I mean, how can one explain these? How can one explain these nightmares?
Yeah.
So one's bound to be affected by them, and they're out there in the world. There's any number of them, but I, other than that, I can't give you a real answer to that.
The you mentioned package tours a moment ago, and I'm wondering, have you and your wife, have you ever done that, say? 10 days somewhere, you know, with all your meals planned and all that. I mean, you both seem, as I read the book, to be people that plan your own trips. And yeah. You travel with people from time to time, your kids especially, but you don't seem like you'd be comfortable in a group of, say, 30 people.
No, I don't believe we've ever done that. We once had a chance to hitch a ride on a boat in Cuba out of Havana for a couple of days, and that was traveling on a small boat that a group of businessmen from Alberta had chartered, and they were looking at the idea of trying to get a boat cruise, a regular boat cruise, going around Cuba, and we were down there looking to see how we could travel around, and that's a pretty good way to get around. Cuba's a big island.
Uh-huh.
It's many, you know, it's larger than you would think, and we wanted to get out and try to get to the far end down near Haiti, the town of Santiago, and this boat was going to just be happening to go and make a stop in Santiago with one stop on the way in a little place called Antilla that I'm not even sure it occurs on a map, but we did do that, and in that couple of days, you know, you take meals on a regular basis, and which we, after one or two experiences, absented ourselves from. We just weren't particularly comfortable in that big formalized mob scene, and we just took our dinner in a little quieter area that they had, and actually, we met an older couple from Jamaica, funny enough, and they became our buddies.
Yeah.
Del and B, if they're listening out there, hi, Del and B. And we ended up hanging out with this great couple from Jamaica who had retired after living in England for many years. So that's not really our preferred way to go, but other people do that, and if that's working for them, well, okay. But it's not one that we've gone for. I mean, I've sailed across the ocean at different times.
Uh-huh.
If you sail across the Atlantic on a boat, it's the same deal. You know, dinner's at 6 or it's at 7 or something like that, and there is a certain kind of minor formality, but it's not, other than that, it's not terribly organized. It's just the mealtimes. But
yeah.
We're not really the type that want to go on the package, you know. It's not our thing. When we travel, we like to try and find a place with some, if we're going to stay a little bit of time, with cooking facilities, just so that we can cook our own meals. And that's important to us. And then you can relax. Otherwise, you're always having to go out looking for things, looking to eat, looking for a place to sit down. And
sure.
So that's not quite our thing.
Yeah, you don't seem to be a spendthrift when it comes to accommodations or food, but you do seem to live well.
Thrifty.
Yeah.
I think I learned that young. There's a story in the book about, living the artist's life or learning to live the artist's life in Madrid, and that was something I got a chance early on, kind of backpacking through Europe and catching a very long ride with a young woman who was leaving home and returning to her sweetheart in Spain. And we got a ride, you know, it must have been for like 500 miles or something. It was an enormous length. And helped her out in winter storms and things, traveling through the Pyrenees, and her car broke down a couple of times. And the guy I was traveling with, the guitar player, we had a little blues act we used to have, singing and playing the blues. He was able to fix her motor once in the night, so in gratitude, she found us a place we could stay with some friends.
Mm-hmm.
And I found myself staying in a house through part of the winter outside of Madrid in a small village at that time, with chickens in the street running around. It's quite poor. Now it's just become apparently absorbed in the city of Madrid. But at that time, it was there were numbers of artists lived there. Orson Welles lived there, and I think Geraldine Chaplin lived there. A couple of well-known footballers lived there.
Uh-huh.
They had houses with big hedges and walls, you know. But this was a house that a number of artists were running, and during the day, it was very silent. It was extremely disciplined. They were working on making prints. They were working on sculpture downstairs. One of them had an apprentice. And then at the end of the working day, around 6 o'clock, everybody would gather. The people's girlfriends and boyfriends would come, and various friends of the community would come in, and there would be a big community cook. One evening, everybody had to take a turn cooking and or washing, and there was no getting out of this. You had to learn how to cook. That's where I began learning how to cook, and I began seeing how to conduct oneself, and they lived absolutely marginally. But the food was great every night, big one-pot meals that a large group of people would share. So you'd have great meals. There would always be great bread because it's Europe.
Uh-huh.
And wine was cheaper than Coca-Cola. You got a bottle of wine cheaper than a bottle of American Coke.
Uh-huh.
So it was good food. It was bread. It was wine, sometimes some cheese and a couple of onions to slice up and some salami. And then everybody would sing and talk, and because it's Spain, out would come the guitars, and everybody would have to sing this is something that you learn on the road. You should always know one or two songs from your home region, because when you travel in these kind of company, you're expected to sing to other people a song from where you come from. And so at, the Red River Valley, the Blue Canadian Rockies, you know, the old Wolf Carter tune, that's a beautiful one.
Yeah.
Those are great to sing to people. So you'd learn how to conduct yourself with these people, live very thriftily, and because there was no heat, it was always very cold in the winter. You'd wake up in the morning, and everybody would get together. There were mostly men in this house. A group of artists would get together and would walk down in the frosty morning to a little village bodega down a little dusty lane past the chickens and go into a bodega and order very strong espresso coffee, which I'd never really drunk before, and they would belt it down with a large shot of inexpensive Spanish brandy. That was your breakfast, brandy Esplendido with maybe a little dish of some spicy octopus left from the night before or some bread. That was it. You learned how to live cheap, and then lunch would be a tin of sardines and a baguette.
Yeah.
And a glass of wine, that would be your lunch. And at that time, that was just under a dollar per day.
Wow.
So that set the model for traveling. And I think you can live thriftily. You can live very well. If you know how to eat, you just eat like the local people. Who are mostly working people. And so that's a good way to go. From time to time, later on as a journalist, maybe you get some assignments where I'd have to fly down to San Diego or fly to Hawaii or something or other, and you live a little better. You stay in a nicer hotel room, and people may take you out for dinner. But you're just meeting local people from the Chamber of Commerce or from some volunteer organization who are welcome a visiting writer and would like to show you around their town, which they have great pride in. And you can still meet fine people that way and live well, just a little better, perhaps.
Yeah, yeah. The memories of food in the book. As I told you in an email that I sent, before while we were planning our chat today, there are a number of places in the book that I wouldn't think of going to, but the memories that you have about food are so vivid, so visceral, that it really does play a big part in how we remember places and people, doesn't it?
I think it does. You know, it's that most human of sensual pleasures, really. I think numbers of people, I think the critics or the book reviews that have come out mention this, and I'm not sure that it was consciously a part of what I was doing, because there's a lot of talk about art and music and history, architecture in the book, and literature, all these cultural signifiers, but food and wine tend to be where you're often with other people, local people, whether it's France or Ireland or, I think last year, about a year ago in Poland, that was an enormous discovery for my wife and I. We had an opportunity to visit Poland. I was reading poetry readings and giving some lectures and had a chance to travel around Poland. And we just didn't expect the fabulousness of the food. The meals were sensational. And people's sense of joie de vivre there was always tied around eating and little drinking and not to excess, but showing you what they'd made or showing, you know, people were bringing, you know, they were making nettle soup from their garden or they were bringing bottles of elderberry wine that they'd made from their father's property or they were bringing cheese from their village, you know. This, our village is 700 years old. This is our cheese.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that was wonderful. Or they'd tell you, oh, you're going to Krakow near the Jewish quarter just before you get to Zarazka Street, just a couple of streets before, there's this little place. You have to go there. Don't miss it. And you walk in, and it's like you've walked into Alice in Wonderland, the most beautiful little restaurant in the world with extraordinary food. And it costs about $5, you know?
Yeah.
So these wonderful moments, I think, yeah, they do get tied to food, and you have a sense of the nature of the people. And I began thinking, you know, people in Ireland are all like people in Poland. The way they respond to food and camaraderie and, you know, making visitors welcome, you start to see these similarities between people that you mentioned earlier, the commonality of humanity.
One's roots, that's something that you talk about in the book. It's something that you, your wife, and your children have explored in your travels. I was going to ask you later on about where you feel most at home, but when considering one's roots, has that changed anything in your life as you've gotten older in terms of where you belong, even?
That's a good question. I think it has. There used to be a great writer in Vancouver. I thought he was the best all-around writer on the arts in the city, James Barber.
Oh, yeah.
And he later became a television guy with a food program, The Urban Peasant, if you know it, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And James said to me, we're in a writer's organization together at that time, when I was first starting out, and a couple of the older writers in town, they were giving me advice and giving a hand or trying to pass an assignment to me. And he once said, you know, Trevor, he said, we know, he says, you're always writing about music or jazz or art for the Georgia Strait or some art magazine. He says, you're going to need to broaden it out probably. He says, and you're always having to knock on doors. I go, right. He says, one of the best things you can do, he says, is become an expert on something.
Mm-hmm.
Become an expert. I go, he says, well, then editors are going to start phoning you. And you don't have to keep going out beating the bushes looking for work all the time. He says, work will start flowing to you. And I looked, and I had been traveling in Asia, and an opportunity came to visit Asia with my wife in the early 80s. And we went, and we turned it into a big, big expedition, a huge voyage. We went through about 12 or 13 countries and took our time and really settled in. And I was astonished at that time by the modernity, the absolute modernity I was seeing in places like Malaysia, a country that at that time it had about 14 million people. But the roads were state-of-the-art roads. You'd think they'd been built by German engineers with American money and Japanese technology or something.
Mm-hmm.
They were just the best I'd seen. And I began thinking, you know, these are better than what we've got back home. And I started to see this part of the world that was just coming up and up and up. And I thought, why aren't I hearing anything about this back home? Why don't I read this back in Canada? And I thought, bing, that's what James Barber was saying, Trevor. You know, start telling people something that they don't know or they're not getting exposed to, that's not being communicated. I thought, this is the spot for me. This is the sweet spot. And I began writing about Asia. I began studying. I became an autodidact. If there were lectures, I'd take them. I started going to UBC Library and reading all the books on Asian literature, studying Asian art. I taught myself something about Asia and took advantage of lectures or classes whenever they came up, which wasn't all that often then. And I really focused on Asia. And for decades, I made this a focus of my career. I wrote books about it, journalism about it, ended up teaching about it. And then, curiously enough, about 15 years ago, my father passed away. And almost as soon as my father passed away, the phone started ringing, and it's the family in Ireland, and they began calling, Uncle Trevor, will you talk to this girl? Who is it? It's your cousin. And I'm going, what's the issue here? And they're going, well, we've got these girls, you know, and the oldest girl, she has to go to high school in September, and we want her to go to the school with the nuns, the convent school, but she wants to go to the public school where there are boys. Will you just talk to her, Uncle Trevor? And I'm going like, what am I supposed to say? They hardly know me. But in Gaelic, there's the word Shanachie, and it's like the old storyteller. Suddenly, I found sort of porting my father's story onto me because I was the eldest now. And I began visiting Ireland more often. My wife and I were coming. We took our kids. And then I thought, there's things here my kids need to know. So we began traveling more and going deeper and deeper into Ireland. And again, it's like Cuba. It's not a big country, but it's very deep. And of course, the layers are thousands and thousands and thousands of years. We can go back 5,000 years and we're still talking.
Yeah.
So I, curiously enough, by traveling all through Asia, I sort of had a method for studying things. And I began studying Ireland more, but mainly through talking with people as I travel around the country. And I got deeper and deeper into my own, you know, Celtic roots. And one thing simply led to another. People introduce you to another person, or you meet a translator.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly one day people are trying to start teaching you Gaelic and speaking in Irish, and you get brought deeper and deeper and deeper into the culture. And then the phone starts ringing, and they're going, when are you coming back home? When are you coming back home?
Yeah.
And I don't know if you were an immigrant with a name like Plantagenet, but if you are an immigrant, there's always that question of, well, where's home?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I wasn't born in Canada. I was an immigrant kid here, and spent most of my life here. And when I travel, I'm a Canadian.
Right.
But then around here, you know, people still routinely, you know, the Irish fell over there, you know, in that house. So as in Canada, Canada's a country full of hyphenations. The French Canadians, I think, started, and then the Italian Canadians and the Greek. We put hyphens on everything over here.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the best thing to do for nation building, but that's the decision that got made. And so there is that question about identity, about self-identity, or, you know, who am I, where am I? Because in a certain point, I guess if you're an immigrant, there's always a certain amount of flexibility, of flux or elasticity about one's... And the roots are important. And you go back home, there I am saying it, you go back home, and everything's familiar to you. Everything's understood.
Yeah.
Sometimes not always here. I notice it, perhaps even now, when my editors correct my prose, you know, when the editors go through, they sometimes revise some of my sentences just because Irish English has a different sentence structure. The way the sentence is, you know, subject, verb, object, it gets reversed in Gaelic. We use a lot of the word the, you know, the Donald, right?
Yeah.
that's an Irishism that they picked up with him in New York. Not that I think he's Irish, but it's just a different language. So the roots of the English even have a certain inflection.
Yeah.
And it comes out even in one's language that good editors pick up.
Your pieces on British Columbia, they capture so much about this place. I mean, the mystery of it for me is something that I felt as I was reading the pieces about here. Even though I don't do some of the stuff that you do outdoors, like, say, hike or even nap, you could have lived anywhere, it seems, but what's kept you here?
Well, it's not like I've stayed here continuously. I've kept leaving. I've traveled. I've gone working out in Alberta at different times, and I realized that's what my dad used to do when I was young. He'd go out to Alberta for work. He was a bricklayer and then in construction, and that's where the work was sometimes. And so I got used to traveling. I went down to do a master's degree in the States there for you know, almost 2 years, and then come back. And I've traveled and come back. And you get offers to go work short-term here and there, and you think, could I make it here? You know, I think the first thing a traveler thinks is, when you go to a new place, is, could I make it here?
Yeah.
And instinctively, we're looking in real estate windows. What does property go for around here, you know? I don't know if you do that. But British Columbia just has this, I think, this tremendous sense of space and openness, the air. You know, just I say to people, sometimes people say, well, why didn't you go over and work in Toronto? Because that's where the something or other is, And
yeah.
I go, I guess it's just the way, it's the angle that the light flows down on the street here, the angle of the sun here. It's Pacific. It's big and green. I mean, those wild mountains,
mm-hmm.
We live here, spend a lot of time near the woods or hiking up the shore. And I think I'm comfortable with it. I'm comfortable with the language here and the way people conduct themselves here. And I've got to know it. I've got to
yeah.
know this place. And you develop a deep affection for it. How can you know? It's a very beautiful place, the Lower Mainland. And then if you start traveling, it's just extraordinary. You start the minute you start going through the beautiful Fraser Valley, and then start traveling up through the mountains around Hope, and you start going either toward Princeton or going up toward Lytton and Cache Creek. It's extraordinary, the Fraser Canyon, and then you come out at the higher plateau country, and you can tell right away this must be great country for hunting deer. Well, it is,
yeah.
And it's cattle country, it's cowboy country, and it's got a different the ecosystem, the vegetation is different, the trees are different. It's an enormous package that we have in British Columbia. And the farther north you go, and I got to see a fair bit of it when I was young, and I think that's part of why I loved it. My dad had to travel for work in the summers, and we had an old Nash Ambassador car that he'd bought, my mom and my sister and I. And we would camp near where he was working, or we would sometimes get billeted with people. And my dad went into business early on with a young First Nations guy from Lytton, Jimmy Johnson. And so Jimmy was able to get my dad jobs working a lot of the native reserves around BC. So we traveled through that country, sometimes in some wild places, quite a bit, and saw a lot. And my dad would be working. As a young kid, about 8 years old, started helping working with my dad, mixing a bit of mud and carrying bricks and then blocks. And it's a good way to grow up, but a good way to see the province and learn how to go fishing. Guys,
yeah.
I caught my first fish up in the Skeena, up in Terrace when I was a kid. And you remember these places. You remember these beautiful places. And we've been going back all through my life with my family and my kids, traveling, That's been wonderful. So it's a hard place to think about leaving, and when I've left it to go live in Alberta on two occasions for work, it's been hard to think about settling there, although there were certainly tremendous offers to do that. I just got drawn back to the coast. I think it's that word Pacific, the Pacific Ocean, the Pacific Rim.
Yeah.
Pacific means peaceful. So it's not always peaceful here, but it's generally Pacific.
Yeah, it's peaceful enough, I guess.
It's peaceful enough,
yeah.
And if you get stuck, it's not hard to find. Just, get on over to Commercial Drive and sit down in a coffee bar there and get a chair in the street and watch the world go by and say hi to your friends going by and neighbors that you know. And,
yeah.
I'm not sure, sometimes you can... There's a guy called Chuck Thompson, a travel writer.
Uh-huh.
And he says, just when you think you've seen everything, there'll always be Canada. Right? And I think there's something to that. And one of the things you learn about travel is that there's these moments where you realize there's the immediacy of this moment in this place, the atmosphere, the light, the sound, the impressions, what's going on around that you... You just realize that sometimes it can't get any better than where you're at. Now, that could be in Laos, it could be in Nepal, it could be in Ireland or out in Hawaii, and it could also be in Vancouver. That's,
yeah.
That's the beauty of travel. I think the pandemic's giving people a chance to do some discovering just about our own place.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people
yeah.
are doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, I have. Yeah, my parents are Filipino, so the part in the book where you and your wife go to Fatima, I found quite powerful. And you've alluded to previous books that you've written, say on Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
You write that you're not religious, but there was that moment in Fatima. Was very special for both of you, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. It's overpowering. It's just, you know, you're in tears. But it's not just Fatima. In Cuba, you know, Cuba's supposed to be a communist country.
Sure,
we know all about it, a revolution. And yet you go out near Santiago, up into the hills, to the Cathedral of the Virgin of El Cobre. That's where the Pope went to visit when he went to Cuba, you know. And Fidel Castro came to see him, you know. I think Castro had tears in his eyes. And we forget these places. That cathedral is also where Fidel and Raul Castro's mother went to pray the night before they embarked on their revolution, you know. And when you go in there, well, here's a communist country that's not religious, so we're told. And you go in there and all the regiments of the Cuban Armed Forces have their badges in this cathedral. They're all praying to the Virgin, you know, for protection. And in Cuba, they call her La Cachita. And everywhere you go, there are the women of Cuba have just taken La Cachita into their heart, and she's everywhere. And it's just an unspoken thing. They've completely syncretized it into their culture, made her their image, and everywhere you go. And you kind of go, why didn't I hear about this? Why didn't they tell us about this? It's not so strange. So Fatima's, actually, I think, you know, I don't know if I say I'm not a religious writer, but I'm certainly interested in spiritual things, and I'm not anybody's particular religious writer, but I think there's a lot of religion in my work. Sometimes it's paying attention in North Africa just to the way Islam works, you know, to travel in Morocco and to hear the muezzins, you know, the call to prayer. In a way, it's kind of reassuring, you know.
Yeah,
oh, I'm here. This is where I am. And I always find in Islamic countries a sense of welcome. People are pretty caring, and we don't feel that we, you know. I mentioned when leaving Morocco, there you go by to say goodbye to people you've been seeing, and you're looking at these young boys you've been doing business with, buying your groceries from and getting your bread from. They never cheat you, you know. I think whether it's Islam or in some of the Buddhist areas where we're going to temples in India or in Japan, wherever it is, that deep sense of gratitude, of recognition, of the one-ment of this whole experience of living, and that's what you get hit with in Fatima. And for me, it wasn't in the old traditional church where apparently the apparitions were seen by the children, you know, of the Madonna, but it was in the... It was in this startling, huge new building. I thought we didn't even know what it was. It could have been a football arena almost, or like an arts theater. My wife said, why don't we take a look and get it out of the way, you know, and check it off the list. And we went in and we realized it's a church.
Mm.
And when we went in, it's got a rake so that you begin walking downward toward the front to the altar area, but it's like super modern, super modern. I was surprised at the church could be so modern and so spacious and airy, and then the beauty of it, and this almost apparition-like image of the Madonna figure, you know. And it wasn't the traditional image from the Southern Europe of a heavy scarf over her head. It was like it was of a young mother that just seemed to be hovering in the air. It's extraordinary. And it's a vast church, and there's numbers of people coming in, and you see grown people standing there weeping. It's just this overwhelming sense of recognition, something deep in their heart. And it's the same thing we see when we go down to Mexico in the month of December when they celebrate Our Lady of Guadalupe. And and all the peasants from the countryside come in, and there are processions with flowers, and the children are singing, and all the mothers are singing your favorite hymns, and the incense is wafting in the air, and there's water blessings, you know, as you're lining up to climb up the stairs into the cathedral. It's like you're in the Middle Ages. It's medieval. It's this total sensory experience that I don't know. I can't think of anything else quite like it in life. We don't have too many of those moments that have this transcendent quality to them, and that's what we encountered at Fatima. But there we are in Poland and visiting the Częstochowa, the Shrine of the Black Madonna, and it's not too different. And it feels very private. You feel like you've been invited something into private kind of worship. And there's the Polish people who stood up to Hitler and had to deal with Stalin.
Mm-hmm.
All of that. And these grown men and women, they're walking on their knees over cobblestones that have been there for hundreds and hundreds of years. They're walking on their knees like they do in Mexico. It's extraordinary.
Yeah.
It's powerful. So that's religious. And I find that tremendously, maybe it's being Irish or being raised Catholic, but I find that it's the most profoundly moving that I can imagine.
And you do such a marvelous job in terms of evoking that, not just in the last few minutes, but in throughout essays in the book. If I talk to you a year from now, do you think you will have traveled anywhere?
Oh boy, there's a tough one, Joe. I would hope so, but, you know, looking at what history has done, and this is all conjecture, but, you know, the Spanish flu took 2 years to wash through. There's all of these vaccines that are being talked about on the news, but how long they would take to be tested and, you know, perfected, and then somehow being able to dispense to billions of people, I don't know. What I just hope is that we get through the winter okay, and that in springtime things begin calming down, and early summer, but about being able to get on a, let's say, an airplane or get on a long-distance train and they start moving, I'm not committing myself. I wish I could.
Sure, sure.
There's things I'd like to see out there in the world. There's places I'd like to go, and people I want to see again. That's one of the things I think that great, you know, that travel does. If you travel with an open heart and an open mind, you end up making friends along the way who become very deep friends.
Mm.
And sometimes they come and visit us, and oftentimes we go back and see them. And those are special journeys. You get some special places you like to go, or some certain kind of places attract that. And it would be nice to get back and see some of these people, you know, and some of whom have sent stories during the past year that have been tough. They've lost loved ones, or, you know, you wish you could see them and, you know, enjoy their company or bring some comfort.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, as a lot of the reviewers have said, this book has given a lot of readers a great deal of comfort these past few months, and I urge people listening to us to pick up the book, because they'll be moved and learn a great deal. By the way, before I let you go, I wanted to ask you about visiting graveyards. Some people might find that morbid. I rather like doing it myself.
Not at all.
Yeah, I like doing it myself, but usually for like you do, for famous people, because I do believe, say, the ordinary person deserves to rest in peace. But what do you what's the attraction for you?
I think it. I can remember very clearly. I'd had a little emotional, as young men often do in their personal lives. When I was in my 20s, I was a student, and you know, something had fallen apart, and I was in a kind of vulnerable state, fragile state,
mm-hmm.
and I ended up going to Paris, and I was in Paris, and I was staying in a small hotel on the left bank, and I was thinking, well, what the hell do I do now that I'm here? You know, I went to the art gallery today to see the great art. You know, it used to be the Jeu de Paume. Now it's the Musée d'Orsay, the great Impressionist collection, extraordinary collection of art. I thought, well, I've been to the big gallery. I thought, what do I do now? I've always gone before up to Montmartre to see the Moulin Rouge, but it was wintertime. It was bleak.
Mm-hmm.
But I happened to be carrying a book with me of Ernest Hemingway's called A Movable Feast, if you know that one, Joe.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Good book. And he writes about his young days in Paris. And he talks about Montparnasse a lot. And I realized the cemetery of Montparnasse was quite nearby where I was staying. And I thought, well, what the hell? I had done a a research piece or a kind of a study and a talk or a performance piece about the French poet Paul Verlaine at Simon Fraser and when I was there. And I thought, I'll go see Paul Verlaine. And I thought, I'm going through this cemetery looking for a couple of famous poets, not just Verlaine, a couple of others I had learned were resting there. And as I was going through, it was a very bleak day. Just, it had been raining. It was raw. I was traveling looking, and I met an elderly French gentleman, and he was looking for the gravesite of his old general from the First World War.
Mm.
And it was quite emotional, and I thought, God, the French took a terrible, terrible pounding in that war. And I joined him in walking, and I mentioned to him I was looking for the grave of some poets, and he found it somehow charming that a young guy from Canada was looking for the grave of some French poets who even he knew.
Yeah.
They were famous. And we joined each other going around this cemetery. And I finally came to the grave of a couple of great writers, and you know, it was like, well, there you are. Nice to say hello, you know, nice to meet. And then it just happened. And then another time I was traveling. I went for, well, I think my brother's wedding in somewhere down in Cornwall. And a gentleman said to me at some pre-wedding event that you have, you know, oh, then you must be familiar with Sir John Betjeman's poetry. You're the writer. And I go, you know, Sir John Betjeman. He says, oh, yes. He says, he's resting just nearby here in St. Enedoc's churchyard. And I go, you know, Stephen Spender. I'd met Stephen Spender. You know, not Stephen Spender, Sir John Betjeman.
Yeah.
But Stephen Spender used to talk about him, an old poet who I had met. And he admired him very greatly for the versatility of his work. And I went to, this man offered to take me to visit the grave of Sir John Betjeman, this wonderful poet who has that poem, The Arrest of Oscar Wilde at the Cadogan Hotel. Wonderful poem. And, gee, that was very moving. And,
yeah.
And then somehow I started just finding this thing. You're in Paris, you can go to the grave at Père Lachaise, up, you know, not too far from kind of the Moulin Rouge area up there. And you can go there, and there's a lineup of people to see Jim Morrison's grave.
Mm.
But not too far away, there's Edith Piaf, there's mm-hmm. Oscar Wilde, Balzac. It goes on and on and on and on, Modigliani, one after another. You know, and you can somehow, you can get a little touch, you know, and you
yeah.
wonder if there's some like little residual energy or residual transmission or something. It's a personal conceit, perhaps, you know, but so I have a chance, you know, down in Mexico, New Mexico, up to Taos where D.H. Lawrence rested for a time. That would be interesting. Or,
yeah.
You know, even like that, I don't know, you know, I think I've just been doing a book review about a biography of Robin Blazer, the Vancouver poet,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
and saw that he's resting in Fraser Cemetery in New Westminster, overlooking the river. That's where my father's buried. I made a point about a week ago, coming home from a little appointment in New Westminster, to drive by the cemetery. I saw the caretaker's shack was open, and I stopped by. I said, I'm going to go visit my dad up there. I said, but do you know where a poet called Robin Blazer might be? And he said, it's right there. Can you see it? It's the one that's... I said, yeah. He said, that's it. I thought, oh. And then he said, since you're here, you know, Raymond Burr, the actor, is just down there.
Gary Mason, yeah.
Holy cow, I didn't know that. You know?
Yeah.
And he goes, and Mandrake the Magician is just up there, who used to be a cartoon. He was a very famous entertainer, vaudeville-type entertainer. Uh-huh. And but they ended up making a weekend cartoon strip about him. He was so famous. So everybody knew him. I thought, oh, well. So you end up making a little visit to these sites and literary graving. It's quite common in Europe. People do this. They leave a little, you know, you leave a little something, and people leave little notes. And I find it very entertaining. I don't go out of my way to do it. It's just something that
sure,
sometimes
yeah.
it's there.
Indeed,
you know?
Indeed.
I did in the book. We make a visit to the grave of one of my favorite writer, Ryszard Kapuscinski. Ryszard Kapuscinski was this Polish journalist
mm-hmm.
who really just brought this whole idea, I think, of creative nonfiction to us in the early 80s when his books began getting translated into English. Granta magazine in London used to publish them,
mm-hmm.
I couldn't put the darn things down. They were just irresistible writing. And I got to know him. I got to be able to bring him to Canada on invitation once and for a festival in Calgary, and got to meet him and spend time, and turned out he had a daughter that lived in Vancouver, and we ended up getting quite close and corresponding, and here I had a chance to be in Warsaw, and I knew that he was resting in Warsaw, and somebody I was seeing there who we had met years before in India, a filmmaker, says and tells you in the book, we're talking, and he says, is there anything that you would like to do while you're in Warsaw? And I guess you're supposed to want to go to the opera, the famous gallery, or hear Chopin or something. I said, yeah, I'd love to be able to go by the house where Kapuscinski, the journalist, lived, or maybe where he's resting. And this man said, he talked in Polish to his wife, and he says, her father is buried very near Kapuscinski in the cemetery. He says, would you like to go in the morning? And it was almost, and he was buried. He's buried in a cemetery for national heroes, and it was like a family pilgrimage to see his father-in-law, and for us to visit the great, because everybody in Poland knows Ryszard Kapuscinski. He was a great writer.
Yeah.
So it's a phenomenal experience, and you're talking with somebody that you knew. Hey, hope you're doing okay, pal. You know, you see, there's a jar there. People have put pens in it from all around the world. Other writers, obviously, paying homage and hoping a little bit of the magic will rub off. You know, I think that's part of it.
Have you given thought to where your own remains will be interred, say?
Yeah, I have. Yeah, in the last little while, I think in New Westminster, I think I'd prefer.
Yeah.
I thought, you know, is it Ireland? Is it England? Which is where I was actually born. Wasn't Ireland.
Huh.
It was Irish family in transit. But I think I'd be pretty comfortable in New Westminster, overlooking the Fraser.
Yeah.
Breathtaking view of the Fraser River as you're looking up toward the Garibaldi Range. I just find it's like, that's where my mom and dad are. And when my dad was dying in the hospice, I used to go by on the way home from work, and I would read him from Virgil's Aeneid, from book 6, where he travels in the underworld, and he goes down to the underworld, and it's what we would later come to call, I think, heaven. And he describes the underworld, and he describes seeing his father's old friends and old buddies, and everybody's there, you know? And when my father was unwell, and I began, but the parts of where he's talking about crossing the river and seeing, I began transcribing the view that my father would know of the Fraser River, where we'd grown up in New Westminster. And I began describing that stretch of the Fraser River out past the Portman Bridge toward the Garibaldi Glacier country.
Uh-huh.
And that was how I was describing. I was taking Virgil's words, and I was from the Cecil Day Lewis translation, but I was putting transposing the local Fraser Valley imagery onto that for my dad. And he found it very comforting, actually. So, you know, so I think that's probably where I'd be comfortable.
It's odd how I'm 38, but I'm thinking about things like that. I don't know why, but I guess you do. And when you're thinking about life, you know, you're thinking about where you want to go, not, you know, in the interim, but then, you know, you're thinking where you want to go at the end, and just natural, I suppose, isn't it?
Well, maybe in a pandemic year, it's maybe even more natural.
Yeah.
I think that's, there is a little flickering of this whole business of mortality in most of our minds, I think, you know. It's been a really struggling time. We should all probably be reading a bit of Daniel Defoe's Journal of the Plague Year or something. I haven't, but, you know, how people have got through tough times in the past.
Indeed. I could talk all afternoon with you, and I've kept you longer than I said I would, but it's just been so delightful to chat, and I just have enjoyed this book a great deal. I wish you well, and hopefully the next time we talk, it'll be in better times.
I hope. Well, maybe we can go off the record here for a second, you know, if they have questions.
Well.
Bad person. Okay.
Trevor, I so appreciate your time today. All the best, and thanks for this.
Thank you so much. What a pleasure.
The book is called Road Trips, Journeys in the Unspoiled World. It's from Mother Tongue Publishing. Trevor Carolyn joined me on the line from North Vancouver. In Vancouver, I'm Joseph Planta.